She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks for joining us today. As usual, I'm very excited about the show. I don't have guests on that I'm not excited about, in case you haven't figured that out in 5 years. And I am certain you will be as well, because I don't just pick guests that I'm going to get excited about. I pick guests that I know you will too. Rafe Sagarin is a research scientist at the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment and author of the book Learning from the Octopus: How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. Rafe, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
He rode up here on his bicycle. We're making sure we get pictures of that before he leaves. And it's not a small journey. I'm so proud of you. It's like, whoa, dude, that's very good. So he's walking the walk. Rafe is trained as a marine ecologist. He has spent lots of time in the ocean from the time he was a little boy, thinking about the marvels of animals' adaptability in the face of danger, which I think is what got him thinking about these amazing creatures. And he'll share some of those incredible observations with us in just a moment. So a few announcements. This show is sponsored by Goodwill Industries of Southern Arizona, where changing lives is their business. And if you have anything to do with Goodwill, you know they do change lives. They're not just a retail location. Thank you, Goodwill, for your support and all you do for the planet. And please note that Mrs. Green's World is also a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 radio network back east, where my shows can be heard every Monday and Tuesday on DreamVision7Radio.com on Mondays and Tuesdays. Please check them out at that website. And then remember, we're live here every Saturday at noon Arizona time. I never figure out if it's like PST or MST. So I just say Arizona time because we do things differently here. Rafe.
We're in our own world.
We are in our own world in more ways than one. And we are at MrsGreensWorld.com and invite you to join us each week. Please remember that you can listen on your iPhone or Droid. We're going to make that easier for you in the very near future. And all of the podcasts from the show live on my website for your listening pleasure, again at MrsGreensWorld.com. And needless to say, we're on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram, getting the good green word out. And now a brief word about one of our national sponsors, which I do each week at this part of the show, EcoBella with two C's, an outstanding example of a corporation that's committed to sustainability at every level. They fit in with the mission and vision of Mrs. Green. They sell their safe, eco-friendly makeup and skincare products in over 4,800 locations throughout the U.S. and Canada, and you can check them out at www.ecobella.com. And one of the things I always try to tie in for the show, they are not indeed harming any creatures from the ocean or the land and are committed to learning from nature as well. So take a step forward in 2013 and investigate the chemicals in your skincare and your hair care products, how they're processed, how they're shipped, how they're manufactured, and make a wiser choice. EcoBella might be one of them. And if you go to their website and make a purchase, Mrs. Green in the checkout will get you 10% off. So let's go to the show. Rafe, thank you so much for literally riding up here today.
It's fabulous to be here. Thank you.
Okay, I think it's great. I always like to start with an overview of who you are so the audience can get to know a little bit about who you are. So you do the Reader's Digest version of that, and then we'll get into the book, which is a fascinating, intriguing book and not what I expected.
Well, thank you. Yeah, first and foremost, I'm a marine ecologist. I study the relationships of organisms to their environment in the marine world, but I am not one of those scientists who focuses intently on one little part of one little creature and studies it to death. I have a lot of different interests. Politics has always interested in me, and it was the interface of my life as a naturalist and my interest in politics that really got me into this whole study of how can we make ourselves more secure and make ourselves more adaptable to the changes in our world by looking at what nature does.
Well, was there a point at which the culmination, I mean, you really did start being totally intrigued by tide pools from the time you were a little boy. I have spent hours with my family at the tide pools at the Monterey Bay area, that whole area. Was there a point at which you said, all of my scientific background, education, has such a profound implication for natural disasters, for terrorist attacks, and for our health? Did you have an aha moment, or were you leading up to that or trying to get to that?
Well, I have to say it never would have happened if I stayed in my comfort zone, which in fact were the tide pools of Monterey Bay, where I was doing research on how animals were responding to climate change there. That was really my comfort zone, where I like to be. But on 9/11, I felt so far removed from what was going on back in D.C., where I had close family in the State Department in Capitol Hill. And yet I was out there with my infant daughter in this just beautiful, tranquil place. So I actually found myself way out of my comfort zone. Less than a year later, I was working as a science advisor to U.S. Congresswoman Hilda Solis as she was starting her career in Congress. She's now the labor secretary. And I was there in D.C., way out of my comfort zone, but in a way I was still acting like a naturalist, looking around at the relationships of organisms and people and the environment that was going on. And the main factor in the environment in D.C. after 9/11 was security, security, security. And my aha moment actually came when I was walking into the Capitol Hill office buildings, and I was fumbling to get my keys out of my pocket to put them on the metal detector, which there are all these new metal detectors now. And a young staffer turned to me and said, "Oh, don't bother taking your keys out of your pocket. Just put your hand over your keys in your pocket and you can walk right through." And I thought, oh my God, if a Capitol Hill staffer to save 30 seconds and can adapt so quickly to these new security measures, what would a terrorist do? And that led me to think much more deeply about, well, what does it mean actually to be adaptable, and how can we learn to be adaptable? Well, the obvious answer was looking at nature, because nature's been doing it for billions of years.
So I want to read a quote. I rarely read quotes on the show, but your book really warrants that, and I just think this is one that you can expand on a little bit. "Adaptability controls the sweet spot between reaction and prediction, providing an inherent ability to respond efficiently to a wide range of potential challenges, not just to those that are known or anticipated." That's a perfect segue to what you just said, because that's adaptability. So talk a little bit about more some of the examples in your book about, you know, the adaptability of nature and how we need to really start looking at it. We'll get to who's reading your book in Washington and maybe start writing them.
Yeah, well, at its core, adaptability is the process by which you can change and respond to things, like you said, that aren't predictable. And that isn't just responding to the last thing. So we saw a lot of that in security. You know, someone would try to blow up a plane with a shoe bomb. So now for the next 7 years, everyone's got to take off their shoes. But that's the last thing that happened. It's not
and
the
they
next
won't do
thing
it again.
That's going to happen.
That's
exactly.
I don't really think they're going to load their shoes.
Nature, organisms in nature wouldn't last very long if they were constantly solving the last problem. They need to figure out how to solve the problem that's going to come up. And they can't do it by making some predictive model about what's going to happen, because anything could happen. And so they have to be in that sweet spot. And the way you start to get into that sweet spot is, first of all, you have to be intensely observational about the changes in the world around you. And you can't do that from a place that's far away from the changes. And the best example, and the reason there's an octopus splayed across the cover of my book, is an octopus itself. Now, an octopus, surprisingly to a lot of people, has an incredible brain. It's very smart, it's clever, it's cognitive, but it doesn't use that central mind to tell all the arms what to do when it needs to camouflage itself. It doesn't say, okay, arm one turn purple and arm two turn kind of greenish and arm three maybe fuchsia. You can see already how that would be too slow and it wouldn't get the job done. So in fact, all these individual skin cells spread out across the body of the octopus are each individually responding to the change around them. And that collectively is giving the octopus as a whole its protection and its camouflage. It happens very quick and it happens very efficiently. And that's the first rule of adaptable systems, is they tend to be fairly decentralized. They let individuals closest to the problem solve the problem.
Can you tell the shark story? Because I spent the week telling people about, do you know about the octopus because of your book? Tell the shark story and the coconut shell story. I think people find that quite intriguing.
There are so many great stories about octopuses that you hear. One of the surprising stories about how tough octopuses are came from, I think it's the Seattle Aquarium, where they noticed a lot of their sharks were winding up dead or missing in the tanks. And so they put a time-lapse camera in the tank that could photograph the tank at night or video the tank at night. They had transplanted an octopus into this tank, but they were more worried about the octopus's safety, but they saw the octopus was doing fine. And surprisingly, when they started to look at these videos, they saw it was actually the octopus jumping out of a crevice and literally wrestling a shark to death and eating it, which was really surprised a lot of people. Now, the coconut shell piece is even better.
It's one of my favorite stories in the book.
Here's an ancient creature, an octopus, that very recently has learned to use new things in its environment to adapt. I think this is in the South Pacific, where due to an increase of ecotourism, they would take people out on boats with these half coconut shells, drinks, I don't know what, pina coladas, and people would chuck the coconut shells. And octopuses there learned to take two halves of the coconut shell back to their den and put them together so that when they were threatened, they could create kind of a suit of armor. And they even learned to stick their legs out between the two halves of the coconut and run with the coconut shell armor. It's a hilarious video on YouTube of these octopuses. And it just shows that you can take an organism that's very adaptable and it can learn to be even more adaptable.
And it talks to me, the big intersection there is that people do have, we are superior intelligence. We can make the predictive steps where animals just react to nature and survive. The other example that I just really made me laugh out loud was the one about, I think it was a gorilla in Japan. It was taking pieces of, because the argument you made was people say they can't, that animals don't make tools, they don't prepare. So there's just, you know, a few examples. But tell, that story was hilarious.
Yeah, I think it may have been a European zoo where this primate, I can't remember right now if it was a gorilla or a chimpanzee, but he would in the morning break off little pieces of rock that were kind of crumbling from part of his enclosure and make a stack of them so that when the visitors came to the zoo, which I gather he didn't like very much, he would throw the rocks at them. So here was not just, there's a rock, I'm going to throw it at that person, but thinking ahead, people are going to come in later and I'm going to want to throw something at them.
Planning for it. I know. Yeah. That was those were just kind of humorous. I love the squirrel too, but that's a really good example of how they alert nature for dangers and how they have different signals and their adaptability.
Yeah, this story is really about how subtle communication is in nature and how we can go very wrong by not taking this lesson on. And the story is about a ground squirrel, which you wouldn't think is a very interesting organism. But in fact, a ground squirrel, like many, many organisms in nature, will communicate to their predators. And they do that so that, usually so that they can say, hey, I know you're watching me. It's not worth your time to try to get me. And that is usually a good deterrent because predation is very costly. It costs a lot of energy. And a predator, if it can't sneak up on an organism and kill it quickly, it's probably not going to bother. So what the ground squirrel does is when it sees a hawk or a coyote, it makes a loud alarm call. And that's enough to tell that hawk, you're not going to sneak up on me. I know you're there. But it doesn't do that when it sees a snake. A snake doesn't hear. It wouldn't be useful. So it actually puffs up its tail and kind of shakes it around and kind of a warning message to the snake. But if, and only if, that snake is a rattlesnake, it will actually heat up its tail because rattlesnakes see in infrared. So you see this interspecies communication that is in the language of the predator. And we really failed at this just after the killing of Osama bin Laden, where we posted these videos that were taken in Osama's house before he was killed. And all the newspapers in the U.S. talked about how pathetic he looked and how he was in this decrepit house and he was kind of bobbing up and down like a maniac on the floor and his beard was long. He was unkempt. And so we showed these videos as kind of a propaganda piece. But to the Muslim world, especially the radical Muslim world, this was all the signs they wanted to see that He was living just as the prophet wanted him to live. He kept his long beard despite it being a danger to him to be identified that way. He lived as a poor man, even though he was a wealthy man. He was bobbing in this ritualistic way, which suggested that he was praying as he should be if he were a devout character. So we sent exactly the wrong message to our adversaries, even though we thought we were sending this strong message.
It's a really great example, and I think it segues perfectly into the book. When I started reading it, I thought, well, this is kind of a little bit like, is it pro, let's get the terrorists? Absolutely not. To me, what the book was, and maybe you can give us some examples, what you say is, if we learn from what has happened and learn the adaptability part, start thinking in an adaptive way, not the military machine, we can prevent terrorist attacks. We can prevent things like 9/11 because we'll be reading signs. Is that a fair synopsis?
That's a big part of it, and there's no one aspect. Certainly, right. We need to defend ourselves. Certainly, we need at times to go after our adversaries, and certainly at times we need to be much more observational and looking at what the signs are to understand what kind of dangers are coming. And I worked hard to make sure that this book is not a political book. It's a book about all of us needing to be able to adapt better to the changing world that we live in. And it's not just about security either. It's about business. It's about climate change. It's about teaching. All these areas where there's a lot of uncertainty, we can learn again to be adaptable. Because after all, we are probably one of the most adaptable species on Earth. And it's only been in the merest fraction of time that we've sort of insulated ourselves from that daily struggle which forces all other organisms to be adaptable. Mostly that's a really good thing. We don't want to be in the place where still a billion people on Earth are still not getting enough to eat. But that insulation from that continual selective pressure has left us vulnerable and non-adaptable in some ways.
And almost it's dulled our senses. I mean, that's exactly a very easy way to put it. But okay, in one of the chapters, and this, you know, it's on tide pool security. And again, I have to quote, because there were times in the book, it was kind of like me when I was starting to read Shakespeare. I thought this was going to be a heavy scientific novel book. There is a lot of great science in it, but it is for everybody to read. It's a read that people can understand, the public, an important role for scientists to play, I believe. So you say in chapter 10 tide pool security, fish don't try to turn sharks into vegetarians. What's that all about? That really made me laugh,
that
too.
That was the simplest way I could say what really frustrated me and a lot of people in the early days of the so-called war on terrorism was this idea that we could just eliminate risk. If we only worked hard enough, we could eliminate risk. And it's the same concept behind the war on drugs. In my own field of ecology, we have a war on invasive species. And a very smart ecologist has said, you know, that is not the kind of language we want to use, and it's not the idea we want to pursue, because a war suggests that you can have some final solution and be done with the problem. Terrorism, insecurity are not the kind of things that we can get rid of. We have to learn to live with them. And just like the fish understands it will do everything in its power to avoid that shark. It may even try to make a partnership with that shark, but it doesn't have any concept in its head that it's going to eliminate the idea of predation or the risk of getting eaten. And so we have to understand that we cannot eliminate the risks in our world, no matter what they are, but we can learn to live with them. And one of the things I insist upon is living with risk is not some passive sort of, oh, I'm just going to hide under a rock kind of thing. There are some animals that do that live way down in the deep sea where there's not really any predators, and they do fine, but they don't grow, they don't expand, they don't adapt, and they just live their quiet little life. We don't want to do that. We want to be part of the world and experience it. And living with risk is not something that you just have to avoid the world, but it's how you learn to adapt in an ever-changing world and acknowledge that this world is always going to be changing. There's always going to be risk. How do I deal with it?
There's going to be the fish and the sharks, and you're not turning the sharks into vegetarians. I literally laughed out loud. One of the things that challenges me in reading it is you make a very good case for the adaptability and the ability for the military to adapt. And there's another quote that I love: despite the billions of dollars we poured into foreign wars, homeland security, and disaster responses, we are fundamentally no better prepared for the next terrorist attack or unprecedented flood than we were in 2001. Have you seen any hopeful examples since your book was published about how some of those things have changed?
Well, there's lots of hopeful examples, and they're not, I wouldn't say in any way they're because my book was published. I do
Let's
talk
just say
with
that.
A lot of,
I would love to say that.
I talk with a lot of people in Department of Homeland Security and Department of Defense, and I listen to their stories. And what I keep learning is about all these little successes that come up, sometimes amidst much bigger failures, things that people did that really worked in the Katrina response, despite overall it being most of a failure, and great things that young officers did over in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they were under that selective pressure I talked about, and they learned to adapt very quickly, even when the Department of Defense that they were working for was taking years and years and years just to come up with these up-armored vehicles and stuff. They couldn't wait for that slow process of adaptation. So they learned to adapt themselves, and they did things without even really getting permission of their upper officers. They just did things, and when they worked, just like in nature, they replicated those things. They told their fellow officers and their fellow soldiers, hey, we just did this and it worked. Let's keep doing it. And they did it in other provinces and other places. And by the time the higher brass found out, it was already working. So they said, great, go ahead and keep doing that.
So that wasn't that great. Sorry for my sarcasm. No, it was really, that's a very serious part of the book. Okay, everybody, we have to take a short break. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I'm sure you're thinking a lot today. With me in studio today is Rafe Sagarin, a research scientist at the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment. And we're talking about his book, Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. When you join us in a bit, we'll talk a little bit more of some of the military examples and natural disasters. Please stay here with me.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year. Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we are giving you lots to think about today. In studio with me today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Rafe Sagarin, a research scientist at the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment. I'm sure everybody on the planet will be hearing more about this powerful institute every day. He's author of the book, Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters and Disease. And if that doesn't make you think, I would venture to say you might think about if you're a thinking human being. That's a lot of things in there, but it's like, it's a very provocative title. Okay, Rafe, let's talk a little bit about the military piece of it, because to me, when I read the book, the idea of the military machine is daunting. It's so huge. It's so massive. How can some of the examples that you use help the man and woman on the line if they just read the book, not getting military command to approve everything, which I hope would be a part of the impact of your book. But do you know what I mean? There's you give an example, I think they're called IEDs in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, the IEDs, which are the improvised explosive devices, which were the largest cause of death for U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, is really a tragic tale of the disconnect between the adaptability of individual humans and these large organizations we make, like the Department of Defense. Department of Defense went into Iraq with a plan, all their great planning and prediction about what would happen there, within weeks fell apart because it turned out not to be anything like military conflict we'd been in before. And it was those independent sensors that I talked about, like the skin cells of the octopus, in this case, the grunt soldiers and Marines down on the ground who are seeing that change in the conflict every day, who recognized right away that IEDs were the biggest threat to their survival over there. And one of these young soldiers, a specialist, Thomas Wilson from the Tennessee National Guard, had the audacity to dress down the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, at this press conference. And he said, you know, we're walking around here, riding around here with hillbilly armor, this recycled armor we've got to strap onto our vehicles. We don't have what it takes to deal with this IED threat. And it took the Secretary of Defense by surprise. He said, well, you go to war with the army you have, which is a very non-adaptable statement. So these soldiers continued to adapt. Congress got all up in arms, said, what are we doing? We got to get our men and women the armor they need. Well, the Department of Defense took 3 years to get up-armored vehicles into Iraq. During those 3 years, those soldiers and officers did so many things to adapt and try to stop this IED threat. And the most important thing, which is a big concept of adaptability, is they created what are called symbiotic partnerships, or partnerships. Every organism on Earth has partnerships with other organisms, and often they occur between species you would think would have nothing to do with one another, like a small fish that goes right into the mouth of a big predatory fish and cleans out its parasites, and that big predator won't eat that little fish. Well, that's what we did in Iraq. We started making partnerships with even the people that used to be shooting at us or used to be bombing us, and that created a lot of new intel to the soldiers about who were the remaining bombers and where were they getting the material and where were they putting out bombs. And you can see, and I charted out in the book, that the threat of IEDs in Iraq goes way down before any of these big, cumbersome, up-armored vehicles came into country, which were called MRAPs. Now, the sad part about this story is now we have all these multi-million-dollar 20-ton vehicles called MRAPs sitting in Iraq. Well, the conflict heats up in Afghanistan, so we send them all over to Afghanistan, where they're totally out of place in the environment of Afghanistan. And there are very few roads where you can drive a 20-ton vehicle in Afghanistan. And that means we become completely predictable about where we're going, whereas Taliban are driving around in one-ton Toyota pickup trucks, the most adaptable vehicle ever made, I'd say, and they can go wherever they want. They know exactly where we're going, and you see, unfortunately, that IED threat, really not just a threat, but the actual deaths from IEDs going up and up and up in Afghanistan. And so it's almost like the armor drew the threat right to it. And that's the disconnect between individuals who are clever, who can think, who can work with small groups and fight for their survival and adapt, and these large organizations. But one of the things that I say in the book is that nature never strives for perfection. So we hear on the Nature Channel, Discovery Channel during Shark Week, the great white shark, nature's perfect predator. And I kind of laugh and say, you know, it'd be so much better if it had laser beam eyes. There's no way to measure perfection in nature. All nature does is be good enough to reproduce itself. That's all it has to do. And so a lot of people talk about the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Defense, and say, oh, it's this horrible big bureaucracy and we've just got to get rid of it all. I never say that. I say what you have to do is adapt from within. It can be a small part of the Department of Defense. It starts to adapt, starts to do things more adaptively. And as they have successes, spread that out through the organization. That's a much better way to adapt than tear something completely down and try to build something up completely new. That never happens in nature. Everything in nature builds off past successes and modifies past successes to become more successful.
And quite quickly in many cases. So let's go back to the example of the IEDs. What would people paying attention to your book have done differently about the equipment that were given to the soldiers to have saved, I think it was something like 1,300 lives but from this particular type of warfare, instead of the costly, you know, overreaction, the time, ridiculous, 3 years later, and then having machines that cost all of us millions of dollars that are no longer adaptable to the next war that we got involved with. What intervention could have happened that you would recommend? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but this is what the book is about.
You know, the interventions that did happen, the ones that were most successful, were almost always at that level of kind of captains who have, you know, at their command a small number, not a huge number of soldiers that they can communicate with and give ideas to. And that is actually the brilliance of the Petraeus Doctrine. I know he's been a little out of favor lately, but he really shifted that concept and said, yeah, it's the people down on the ground who really have to make decisions. They have to be a lot more autonomous. They can't be part of a command structure that requires them to go all the way up to, you know, a brigadier general and then back down to approve their orders. And when that started to happen, you started to see change there. And in some cases, you're just in a situation that is too difficult to adapt to. And that's not unprecedented in nature. There are lots of cases where the change in the environment, the threat in the environment is just too much to adapt to. So you could build, you know, if you came out with those up-armored vehicles a year and a half earlier, you still would have lost 600 people. And you still would have had this problem that insurgents were immediately adapting to those up-armored vehicles. As soon as they saw these things are really armored on the bottom, which is where IEDs used to explode, they started creating IEDs that came from the side and went to the weak point. So any kind of armor in nature or in society creates an escalation. And it's often an escalation we can't win. And that's the whole lesson of border walls, of storm walls, like levee walls. We are escalating what's happening in nature, especially with climate change, and yet we're still under this concept that if we make a levee wall that's sized for the 100-year flood, we'll be okay. Well, guess what? That 100-year flood is based on averages from way before storms started becoming more intense and larger. So walls and things like that, armor, they don't adapt. You have to make them all again, or keep building them higher, or something like that. And that's a game you're going to lose eventually.
And with the way that the world is changing, just in the world, in the area of technology, I mean, it's at light speed. So to have these very cumbersome, huge, massive structures where there is a chain of command, it's not going to work anymore. Well, let's go that to the Katrina. You were talking about Katrina and New Orleans and how not only did we build a 100-year wall that didn't work, we interfered with the whole natural landscape. We really messed with Mother Nature and people paid for it and continue to pay for it dearly. So talk about some of the prevention applications that it seemed to me that Sandy was much more, the response time was much faster. People were in place much more, lots more people that were impacted because of the concentration. So talk about, you know, winding in the principles of your book to the natural disaster piece.
Yeah, well, this really hits home to me as an ecologist, because if you look at the environment around New Orleans, and why Katrina was so destructive, it wasn't because it was such a powerful storm. It was a Category 3 storm when it hit land, but where it hit was in this big canal that the Army Corps of Engineers had dug straight through these wetlands called the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, or Mr. Go, as it was known. And it was just a straight cut through these wetlands. Now, wetlands are this complex, topographically complex, diverse environment that really does a great job of reducing any storm surge that comes through them. But now we have this straight line that goes right into New Orleans. It is like rolling out a red carpet for a storm. And that storm just marched right into New Orleans. The thing about the response and the after action, as it's called, after the dust settled and the water settled and we looked at what did we do wrong and right, and I see this throughout government agencies and in a lot of companies, there was a huge focus on what went wrong. And I absolutely agree. It's important to identify your failures. But there was almost no effort to look at what went right in Katrina. What did some organizations do correctly? And these are the stories I start to hear when I talk to individuals who are down on the ground. A gentleman from the Maritime Administration who said, you know, we normally move things like, you know, tanks across the Pacific, across the Atlantic Ocean, but we had all these boats, all these barges available. So we set them up as mobile command centers because you couldn't go on roads or anything like that. That worked really well. The Coast Guard cleaned up and contained a 9 million gallon oil spill. No one ever heard about that. It did not make it into this massive after action report that the government put together. Now, when would it be useful to learn about the success of cleaning up oil in the Gulf of Mexico under really difficult... Oh, right, the very next disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, which was Deepwater Horizon. But we hadn't learned from the successes of the response to Katrina. Now, I think by the time that Sandy came along, a lot of disaster managers were realizing, you know, there's some things we can learn from failures, but there's a lot of things we can learn from successes, like having mobile command centers that are easy to pick up and move and get into place as soon as you need them. The other thing that was obviously done well in Sandy was a great observational sense of, you know, this is going to be a danger. There was much more awareness of people. I should put a little aside that my folks did not evacuate from the Connecticut coast, and I was very mad at them about that. There is always going to be the problem of getting at certain stubborn individuals who won't go, but...
And are they okay? You just have to tell that part.
I will say that they are okay.
Okay,
and
good.
For one of the first times, my father did apologize and say he was wrong because he was stranded for several days without power and uncomfortable, but fine. Looking at the early warning signs, you saw how seriously Governor Christie took the reports from the National Weather Service, and it's something we're learning. Things like the National Weather Service, things like the USGS, the US Geological Survey, are incredibly important roles that a government can play is providing that sense. But the other thing that's starting to happen in disasters everywhere is spreading out those observers of what's going on, especially in the aftermath of the disaster. This is called disaster mapping, for example. And here's where technology is really aiding us in a symbiotic way, working with our own adaptability, because if you can get people out, far more out into places where big government agencies, where UN organizations just don't have the capacity to get out, and they're reporting what's going on in their cell phones. Hey, a bunch of people in my village are sick. I think maybe they have cholera or something. You can start to map this out very quickly and see where do we need to send resources very quickly. And so you can get a much faster response time. And really, most of the world, even in surprisingly poor places, in places we'd consider primitive or something, they have cell phones. They're using them. And people are using them not just to map out disasters, but to map out places where new emerging infectious diseases are arising. that's usually going to come up where people are still hunting bushmeat and, you know, having bloody carcasses of animals over their shoulder. So those people are now able to report back to a network and say, hey, there's this weird new disease in my village. What's going on? An organization like the UN would never have the capacity to send out people that far
and respond to that
from, you know, a city, and unless they're getting that information in from people who are actually there on a daily basis.
So it's to me, there's some things to be learned from this. I'm a Jersey girl, and I saw the Jersey Shore destroyed, not to the extent it was. I was talking to people constantly. Are there some examples where no matter what we do, like the people at Rockaway, they have gotten hit so many times, and then it was fire? Should we take cues from nature and like move back? Because these are scary things that are happening and costing lives and costing, you know, ruining lives for the people that are alive. Some of them, their lives are ruined forever. It has such a ripple effect. So what can we learn from nature in terms of that response in less than 2 minutes when we go to a break?
There's certainly places where it doesn't make a lot of sense to rebuild. I used to live in North Carolina, and the barrier islands out there, they're going under. You know, they're going underwater, and more local politicians are realizing, you know, we just can't keep letting people rebuild these, you know, multi-million dollar houses. And it's a nearly impossible task on the individual level, because if you've invested in that place, both your money and your sense of home, that's where you believe your home is. How can you tell someone, you know, that's just not going to be a viable home? But there are certain ways that we don't have to subsidize that, you know, where we're putting in flood insurance to rebuild houses in places that we know at the next storm or the next rise of sea level is going to, you know, affect those places and make them places where we have to put more resources to protect. That's something where we can cut that down and let people make decisions. Do I want to live with this risk when I'm totally you know, on the hook for it, basically.
But then just kind of knowingly go in, and I've listened to nature and I still want to build my house here knowing, because I've spent hours listening to the analysis of the perfect storm, which Sandy was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a combination of events, and it may never happen again in our lifetime, but what do we learn from it, to me, is one of the most important things, because it was so devastating and so close to so many of us. Okay, we are going to take another short break. Learning from the Octopus with Rafe Sagarin, how secrets from nature can help us fight terrorist attacks, natural disasters, and disease. We'll talk about connecting with nature when we come back. Please stay here with me.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some exciting news. The all-new 2013 Honda Accord is here. It's got a new level of sophistication. It's an efficiency expert, and when you drive one, you can discover how EcoAssist can help you increase your fuel efficiency. For a record 26th time, the Honda Accord has been named to Car and Driver's esteemed 10 Best list. To check them out, visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street. They have a great selection of 2013 Accords in stock right now.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Are you thinking about swapping out your old items for new? Think Habitat when you do. Don't trash it. Have a store it. Habitat for Humanity Tucson will resell your donated furniture, appliances, and building supplies and use the proceeds to build affordable homes in the greater Tucson area. Call now at 520-889-7200 for a free pickup. You can bring your donations to Habitat's Habit Store at 935 West Grant Road, just a quarter mile east of I-10. For more information, go to habitattucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you have been with us for the whole show, which I hope you have, your thinking might be on overload. I said to Rafe when we were off air, I get so captivated by his answers that I forget that I'm supposed to ask the next question. That's a good thing, Rafe. Don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, so that you can stay in touch with me about great guests like Rafe. And Rafe, let's say it right now and at the end of the hour, how people can get a copy of your book, which I highly recommend. I mean, you can tell with me if I'm really excited about it or not, and I'm really excited about it. I mean, I was showing people the notes, which we don't have a camera, but I mean, I took copious notes, and I could have made, you know, a picture of the first three chapters could have been the show. So how do we get a copy of the book? And
yeah, well, if you're in Tucson, just go to Antigone Books.
Locally owned, wonderful, and lots bookstore. Of great cards.
If you're anywhere else, you can go to Powell's.com, which is a great bookstore up in
Portland
that carries a book. Of course, Amazon carries it. If you're one of those people who likes to read on an electronic gizmo, it is available on Kindle and other electronic formats. So you can go to learningfromtheoctopus.com. And you can also hear other ideas about adaptability and see some of my videos on adaptability at adaptablesolutions.org. So lots of ways to get in touch and to continue the conversation. And I'm always open to readers and readers of the website's comments. And I always respond because some of the best ideas about being adaptable are ones that I haven't even heard yet.
And because you are, no pun intended, you're adaptable. So you want to hear what people have to say. One of my biggest beliefs, a core belief, is that something that is quite broken, that can be fixed, is we are not connected with nature. And I wrote my first newsletter of the new year saying it's all about living consciously and connecting, because that's where all sustainability begins. If you feel connected, you're not going to trash, you're not going to overuse. So talk about, especially with our kids, like my grandchildren love being outside. Put them outside and they fly. What can we do about it with such urban environments? What's your thought about that and how it's impacted our ability to think as adaptable species?
Yeah, absolutely. That is at the core of learning how to be adaptable, is being an observer of a complex world. You cannot learn to be an observer of a complex world in an office. You can't learn it by playing video games. You can't learn it by anything, no matter all the awesome things that are on the web now, none of them can teach you how to observe a complex system like nature and learn how to understand its patterns. The only way you do that is by getting out into nature, hopefully from a young age, but the more time you spend in nature, the more forest hours, as one of my colleagues calls it, the more ability you have to see patterns and to understand the way that a complex system changes. No one can take it all in, all that information, but the best naturalists, the best people in my field, are the people who have observed and observed and observed and observed. The best athletes are the ones who are constantly practicing in their complex world of a hockey game or a basketball game, and they learn to observe all that complexity and make patterns out of it. That's why those people seem to predict the future. They seem to know exactly where to pass the ball or where to be to receive a pass and make a goal. It's actually that they're not predicting the world, but they have a great sense of how all the complexity is going to come out into some pattern. And that's what really good naturalists do. I talk about a character who I worked with in the book, Gary Vermeer, and he provided us with a lot of ideas about how adaptable systems work. And he is one of the best observers of nature. He can tell you anything about fossilized snails and fossilized crabs and how they lived. And the amazing thing is he has been blind since he was 3 years old. So all of his observation is just how he touches nature and what he feels when he's running his fingers over a fossilized shell or something like that. So it doesn't matter what sense you use. And in fact, we vastly underuse everything everything but our visual sense. I talk about another observer of the world, Daniel Kish, who is also blind, but he observes everything by echolocating. He makes clicks and he listens to what comes back, and he can ride a bicycle. He can hike by himself for 8 miles on a trail, clicking for trail signs and splits in the trail and stuff. And it's because he's massively practiced the art of observation, only observing with his hearing in that case. So we have a massive unused capacity to observe the world. And the more time we spend out in nature, in any environment, it doesn't have to be in a wilderness. It could be just the urban environment, the parks. There's nature all around us. The more we're out in that real world that doesn't just focus in ones and zeros like a video game, the more we learn to deal with that wonderful complexity around us.
And it's so much fun. I have to say that. I don't mean to be pithy, but when we have our grandchildren here, the most fun we have is when we are out somewhere doing something and interacting with them and getting them excited about what they're doing. They get us excited because they're watching and their senses haven't been dulled. So that's a big part of what you're saying. Let's go back to the book a little bit and tell me what kinds of things have come about since you wrote it. One of the things that Gary Hart said, and I will paraphrase it, is that it was people should be listening and watching, and are they? This book should be a handbook for the field, not just for the military. I don't want to just focus on the military because the animals knew the tsunami was coming. They did. I mean, I've read lots about the animals. Their senses were activated, and they knew there was a glitch in the matrix. So talk a little bit about what's your dream, your greatest hope, because this is a purposeful book.
Yeah, well, I've been fortunate to be able to really share this book with exactly the audiences that I've wanted to talk to, which are the real practitioners in the field of not just security, but also disaster management, emergency response, disease management, the ones who are really going to make a difference. So one of the most satisfying talks I gave was to an annual meeting of the American Red Cross. And I talked about all the attributes of adaptable systems. And the very next day, one of the CEO for disaster management in the Red Cross gave his keynote address. And he said, let's look at how the Red Cross has done based on the octopus scale. And he had created himself an octopus scale, which was taking all the ideas about adaptability and then scoring the Red Cross's performances in terms of how well did they decentralize response, which is something the Red Cross actually does very well because there are volunteers in every community everywhere ready to act. How well did they use symbiotic partnerships, and how well did they use redundant systems, which is another thing. How well did they learn from their successes? So that was really exciting to see that becoming part of the practice of a big organization with a lot of little people out there doing their work, which is the Red Cross. I've also been fortunate to work with the Navy Postgraduate School, which actually teaches, this is a school in Monterey, California, that actually teaches courses called a Master's in Homeland Security course. And it's not just military people that they teach to, but they teach to local, state, federal, first responders, fire chiefs, police chiefs, air marshals, people in Department of Homeland Security. So you get this wonderful mixed audience. And I learn so much through interacting with those groups and saying, you know, what have you done? What's worked? And how have you adapted? And I hear stories from Hurricane Sandy, and I hear stories from Katrina, but I hear stories also from, you know, a mad cow disease outbreak or whatever. So I hear from a lot of different people, and those stories become interwoven into the ideas that I present on how nature adapts.
And the storms are such good recent examples. I mean, there was a space between Katrina and Sandy, but talking to friends back there, I kept saying to them, how in God's name could the electricity still be off? It's New Jersey. And my friends said, Murph, remember big trees? They're down on every street. They're in houses. They've felled telegraph lines and phone lines. So it was a disaster, very different from that because of the concentration of people. But the response, all I could hear from everybody I spoke with was that decentralized response where communities were just, there was just an outpouring of getting it fixed and getting shelter for people. So many moving parts.
Yeah, one of the things that another scholar has written about in terms of disaster responses, the most successful communities, no matter what, it doesn't matter how rich or poor they are, it's the number one factor in how well communities respond to a disaster is how well do they know their neighbors. And how much does that link back into exactly what you're saying about getting out into nature? Because if you stay in your house, you will never meet your neighbors. You meet your neighbors when you're out walking, when you're out planting a garden or whatever. And those neighborhood connections are the number one factor in how well communities respond to a disaster, because neighbors are looking out for their neighbors. They have things that they can use to help their neighbors. Oh, hey, Bob, I have a generator here. Why don't you come over and spend the night here and you'll be better. So that all links back together to getting outside, not being cloistered in our houses, and making a network that can respond more effectively, more adaptively to whatever hits us.
So I like to get into the dream machine at the last part of the hour. What are some of your plans for your life and what you're going to be doing next to make a difference? I cannot believe that you said off air you're going to write another book. So when the show's over, I want to ask you, when do you have time as a father, as a research scientist, as an author to write that next book? It blows me away.
Well, fortunately, one of the things I found in writing this book and this other book I just put out called Observation and Ecology is that I've been a scientist for many years, where we write these very narrowly scoped papers that have very specific requirements about how you write them. And those are incredibly difficult for me to write. Writing a book where I can tell stories and I can all of a sudden go off on a tangent about teaching our dogs to avoid rattlesnakes or whatever was the easiest thing for me. So these books practically wrote themselves because it was just like I was telling stories, which I like to do. So
tell that story, because people that are listening from all over the country,
yes, sorry.
You had to adapt when you came here. And I actually heard a presentation and saw that woman do rattlesnake aversion training, a demonstration at my Rotary Club.
Yeah. So when we moved to Tucson a little over 3 years ago, we thought it would be a good idea to teach our dogs. We have two dogs to learn about rattlesnakes, because dogs can get hurt very seriously by rattlesnakes. So we take them to this rattlesnake training place where they actually, they put a little shock collar on the dog and they show them a defanged rattlesnake who rears up and gets angry. The snake's in a little cage. And they, at the same time, give the dog a little shock and the dog jumps back. It's like, what was that? Then they do it again with another rattlesnake. And by the second shock, they just have to, they take off the shock collar and then they walk the dog around and show him a rattlesnake again. And the dog jumps about 10 feet from that rattlesnake. And right after
they
that
got
training,
it. They adapted.
Well, they got it for that. But then my daughter said, well, what about scorpions? Do we have to take them to scorpion training now too? And so that's what I say is, you know, there is a difference between just that simple learning where it's just like, okay, here's the stimulus, here's the effect, versus a more adaptable learning where you have to think about risk more generally. So fortunately, our dogs have not been bitten by rattlesnakes or scorpions, but...
But you know what that told me? Your daughter's thinking. She's adapting. She's
out
enough. The
daughters thinking about the next thing down the line.
Right.
Yeah.
So another book, tell us, Observation Ecology, is this more for the scientific community, or is it, again, a book like Learning from the Octopus, where it's something that someone like me, the mainstream people without scientific backgrounds, would thoroughly enjoy reading. Anybody can read your book.
I wrote with my Chilean colleague, Anibal Pochard, Observation and Ecology, to be a readable book. It's kind of written at the undergraduate level, because I wanted to show students that there's much more to science, especially right now, than what you're going to learn in your basic biology or basic science class, which a lot of students tell me, oh, I always wanted to be a marine biologist, but biology in college was so boring. And it is really boring. And what this book is about, and it's a little thin book, it's about how exciting it is to be a life scientist now, when just like in the early days of Darwin and people like Ed Ricketts, people like Rachel Carson, we're relying on our observational senses again, because we have to. When we want to understand how this planet is changing as a whole, we can't do little experiments in a laboratory anymore to understand that. We have to look at the world, and we look at it with our eyes and our senses. And I talk about Gary Vermeer in this book as well, the blind paleontologist. years, but we also can use all this incredible new technology like satellite data and genomics to really see the world and its changes. And so this book is really about what an exciting period and an important period we're in the life sciences, where so much is happening to our planet and we need to understand it. And we can't do it in that little reductionist laboratory way that we had been doing it.
No, and you have amassed a wonderful team. The Institute of the Environment is growing. It's learning about people like Scatman Ashwin, who mm-hmm. is studying wildcat scat out in the wilderness. So thank you very much for taking the time to ride up here today and be with us. Rafe Sagarin, author of Learning from the Octopus, How Secrets from Nature Can Help Us Fight Terrorist Attacks, Natural Disasters, and Disease. I want to say next week a quick shout out. We have Daniel Reardon, author of The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. He will share with us highly detailed planetary-wide blueprint for how our new course of technology industrial engines can help avert global collapse. Rafe, thanks so much. It was really great listening to you. And everybody, thanks for listening and being part of Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Check it all out, mrsgreensworld.com. The podcast will be up by Monday.
Great. Thank you.